Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
from erased to back in the race, the U.S. Supreme Court rules Donald Trump can stay on the ballot in the Colorado Republican primary and in every other state, too.
All hell breaks loose. The already chaotic situation in Haiti deteriorates even further after gangs help hundreds of inmates escape from prison.
No chips to cash in. The Covered Bridge potato chip factory in New Brunswick burns to the ground, which is bad for people who love the product, but even worse for the community of people who work there.
Overdue notice. A year after being fired for pushing back against book bannings, a Texas librarian files a federal lawsuit for wrongful termination.
First and foremost, a tribute to Eleanor Collins, the BC singer known as Canada's First Lady of Jazz, a pioneer as a black woman in Canadian broadcasting, and someone who captivated audiences well into her 90s.
And score tactics. Caitlin Clark breaks a U.S. college basketball scoring record that stood for 54 years. Her high school coach tells us records never drove Ms. Clark, so we'll ask her what does. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that would love to break a basketball record, but that's just wishful thinking. Donald Trump's name will appear on the Colorado primary ballot tomorrow. The U.S. Supreme Court has unanimously ruled that the former president can remain in the Republican primary, overturning a state-level ruling that disqualified him, and the Supreme Court ruling applies in other states as well. Those who attempted to kick Mr. Trump off the ballot in Colorado argued that a long dormant provision of the Constitution made him ineligible because he engaged in insurrection. The Supreme Court justices rejected that claim, saying the Constitution does not allow a single state to disqualify a presidential candidate and that doing so would create chaos. The decision comes just before Super Tuesday, when more than a dozen states, including Colorado, hold their nominating contests. Mark Hellman is a former Republican state senator in Colorado. We reached him on the road in Russell, Kansas.
Mark, you do not support Donald Trump, but you also do not support this effort to get Trump kicked off of Colorado's primary ballot. Why not?
No, that's right. I believe that in America, the people get to decide who their candidates are, whether I like their choices or whether they do not. So removing a candidate from one party's consideration through a lawsuit is just a wrongheaded approach.
So if you've had a chance to look at the Supreme Court's reasoning, its decision, what the justices wrote, and quite extraordinarily posted it online as well, given the interest and the timing ahead of Super Tuesday, what did you make of the court's reasoning to keep him in the race on this ballot?
Well, what was really reassuring to me was the fact that in a case where the court really needed to be unanimous to show that this was not a political decision, that this was based on the law, that they did achieve that unanimity. It was very important to conclude that Colorado can't simply deny Republicans across the nation the opportunity to make their choice for president, just like what we call red states can't make that decision to take a Democrat off the ballot. And I think the justices recognized that this was a very dangerous road to go down.
You know some of the people who brought this case to court. Four of the six who launched this case were Republicans, including Krista Kafer, who we had on the program not too long ago. And she said this was about holding Donald Trump to account for his actions on January 6th. And she said she would expect Democrats would do the same if their candidate had acted as Donald Trump did that day. So do you understand why they wanted to take this action?
I do understand. Krista is a friend of mine. Norma Anderson, the lead plaintiff. Mm-hmm. She and I actually were co-majority leaders of the Colorado Senate for 2 years. I understand where they were coming from. I think they got bad legal advice. The fact that their plaintiff's counsel didn't really seem to be prepared to answer the question about what do we do with the language in the 14th Amendment that says that removing someone has to be authorized by federal law. To me, that was a glaring oversight. So I understand why, for people who are even more opposed to Donald Trump than I am, that they might be looking for a way out of what I think is going to be a very painful process for our Republican Party. But I think we have to let the people have their voice, make their decision, possibly live with the consequences of their decision, and then work that out for themselves.
Do you think Donald Trump is fit to hold the office of United States president?
I don't think either of the two front runners of our major parties are fit to be president. So I am very concerned that our two major political parties don't seem to be equipped right now to make the choices that are necessary to give Americans two good choices to vote for rather than two choices which many Americans will simply determine who are we going to vote against.
You wrote back in October, quote, as a Republican who desperately wants my party to end its cultish relationship with the 45th president, I know that legal shenanigans only tighten Trump's parasitic grip on a large segment of the GOP, end quote. If this kind of legal action is not the right avenue, what's going to end that relationship?
Perhaps either nominating Donald Trump and seeing him lose, or perhaps, and this is an outcome that I don't look forward to, nominating Donald Trump, seeing him win, and seeing a much different presidency than they saw for the first 4 years, when I think a lot of his lesser instincts were tempered by having good people with good experience around him. I don't think that will be the case if he's elected again in 2024.
You've said you don't support him for this. So given everything that's going on,
correct,
you don't support him.
Correct.
And people know
no,
that.
No, I have.
Sorry, go ahead. No, you go ahead. No, you go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you're right. I have a Nikki Haley sign in my front yard.
So what do you think is going to happen in the Colorado primary, the Republican primary tomorrow?
Oh, I'm fairly confident that Trump will win. I think the question is how many Coloradans, as well as people in the other states, actually bother to take time to vote, since it seems to be in many cases a foregone conclusion what the outcome is going to be. I will tell you, I sent my ballot in the day that I received it, but I know from talking to a number of my Republican friends, it's almost like they are impervious to reasoning when it comes to discussing Donald Trump, and that's frustrating. It feels like I've stepped into Invasion of the Body Snatchers in some cases.
You are supporting Nikki Haley. You've got a sign on your lawn. She said she'll stay at least until Super Tuesday, but, you know, certainly she's way behind, and you seem to sense where things are going. Are you going to vote for Joe Biden in the end, if it's Trump-Biden?
No. I can never vote for Joe Biden. It is highly unlikely that I'll vote for Donald Trump, because I talked myself into it in 2020, and then after watching his escapades, in the 2 days, much less 2 months after the election, I wish I had had my vote back. But what I really think is sad about the path that we're on from both political parties is that I think that the day after the election, the person who wins no longer has the other candidate as a foil. And so the rest of America is going to be very disappointed with the outcome, including a number of people who vote for the winner because they simply find him to be the lesser of two evils. And that's really, I think, what we have seen in the last two presidential election cycles. People like Donald Trump because they felt that he was the lesser of two evils versus Hillary Clinton. And then they picked Biden for the same reason versus Donald Trump. And lesser of two evils elections are just not a way to bring Americans together and to move our country forward when we have so many huge problems that we really need to address.
Mark, I'm really glad we could speak. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Mark Hillman is a former Colorado state senator. He was in Russell, Kansas today. If you know Maritimers, you probably know that when a big winter storm is coming, they like to stock up on chips. And in New Brunswick, people favor one brand in particular, Covered Bridge. The chips have become a known quantity, not just locally, but across the country. Here's a Rick Mercer report from several years back.
Welcome to Heartland, New Brunswick, home to the world's longest covered bridge, but more importantly, ground zero for delicious, because it is here that magical elves gather and make wonderful potato chips, or at least that's my theory. Today, I go inside the Covered Bridge Potato Chip Factory and uncover the secrets behind civilization's greatest invention, the chip.
This weekend, the factory where those chips are made burned down. Several dozen employees got out safely. Authorities are investigating the cause. The destruction of the Covered Bridge factory has rattled a lot of people in the area and prompted the premier to issue a statement calling it a heartbreaking loss. Tammy McLean is a local amateur historian. We reached her in nearby Watson Settlement, New Brunswick.
Tammy, what were you doing when you found out the factory was on fire?
Well, me and my son was in Woodstock here at a Broadway Irving, and I heard someone mention it, and I said, no way, you know, because we had a fire a day before in another little place out here in Jacksonville. And so I was like, oh, my gosh, the Covered Bridge Factory. I said, oh, my gosh. So when we left, we went up on the overpass on the 95, and it goes looks straight up towards the Heartland area, and you could see the smoke just coming from there.
Have you been able to speak with people who were inside about what might have happened?
The other day when I went up after the fire there, I was talking to several people who worked there, and some of them are crying and upset and devastated, you know, about what happened, you know. So, I mean, it was a big fire. I mean, it was so bad.
You were able to get closer the day after the fire, as I understand it. What did you see?
So when I went up, and I don't know, you know, where the area is, but it's off the main highway, four-lane highway there, so there was nothing left. I mean, it was burnt right down to the ground. It was one of the most devastating fires I have ever seen.
Any sense of what happened?
Supposedly, it started in the fryer area there, and I guess they couldn't get it out, and it spread from there, from what one of the person was saying, that they got everybody out safely, so...
That's good, at least.
Yeah.
And you know the Albright family, the family, you know,
who
owns this factory and has been in this business for quite some time.
They're a five-generation family.
How are they doing?
I haven't spoke to them personally yet. Mm-hmm. I've been wanting to leave them alone. Mm-hmm. But I can just imagine how devastated they are. I mean, they built that factory in 2009 with community support, you know, and... they built from little to up and expanding a few years ago to, you know, where it is now, a big national brand name potato chip.
Yeah. What makes the chips so special?
They're made from local russet potatoes that they have grown in their own fields.
So they're the farmers as well as the factory owners.
Yeah, right here in Woodstock, Jacksonville area potato fields, yeah. So, I mean, they grow their own potatoes.
So it's an economic engine for the community as well.
Exactly.
There's an investigation, as we've mentioned. You know, the premier has weighed in. What have you heard about that investigation?
Well, I just seen a link there a few minutes ago there about the RCMP investigating it also. So I don't think it's going to be a long investigation. Yeah. It's pretty obvious, you know, to the people what happened. So I don't know how long that'll take, but...
What do you like about the chips?
Well, the flavors. I mean, they come up with so many different flavors of chips. They're really tasty. The dill pickle ones and the salt vinegar ones. And then you got to have the famous storm chips.
Storm chips. Yes, I remember
storm
all the
chips.
Talk.
If you haven't got a bag of storm chips, get your chips.
Well, what have you done since you found out about the fire? Have you been stocking up?
Yes, that day that I went up there to get pictures and video there, right across from the chip factory is a Fenn's Market that had the Burger King and Subway on the end. So I went in and I actually got a person to get a picture of me grabbing some of the chips there. So I got like 3 or 4 bags there and another 3 or so bags at Sobeys here in Woodstock. So.
But you're not opening them, are you?
No, I'm going to keep them for quite a while until we find out what's going to happen here. Hopefully they'll rebuild.
Yeah, what's your sense? I mean, I know this has all just happened, but do you think they will absolutely rebuild, given that it's such a big business there?
I'm hoping that they do. Yeah, I mean, the name is so big around everywhere that I don't think they want to lose that. And so I'm hoping that they do rebuild.
You mentioned you were speaking to people who work there. You know, we heard in that clip from Rick Mercer from right around the time that factory had just opened. It sounds like 2009, like you said. It's not magical.
Yeah, he was there. I didn't get up to see him, but
you remember it.
Yeah, oh yeah. It was. I have like history groups for my area here, and when I shared that, it was shared I don't know how many times.
Yeah. Well, he said, he thinks it's magical little elves. Like, certainly they do, they do great work. But in all seriousness, these are real people whose livelihoods depend on this factory. So what are they going to do in the meantime?
So I'm not really sure about the employees, but I know that the government and the Albright family themselves will help get the unemployment through as fast as they can. The Albright family has been, like I said, five-generation family around here, and they're really good people, and they'll help you out.
Well, we've seen, communities come out in the past after difficult times like this. Do you think folks there are going to come together to try to help?
Already are. We're having a benefit breakfast here on Saturday in Jacksonville, and all money will go to the employees of the factory.
That's great. Chips on the menu?
Probably will be. When you live in a small area like we do, you got communities that are like 15 minutes away, 20 minutes away in all directions. And everybody knows everybody.
Tammy, I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it talking to you there. It's quite interesting. I've never been on a radio like this.
Well, glad to have you. Thanks, Tammy.
All right. You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Tammy McLean is an amateur historian. She's in Watson Settlement, New Brunswick. Canada is saying goodbye to the woman known as its First Lady of Jazz. Eleanor Collins began singing professionally in the 1930s. She went on to perform with the likes of Dizzy Gillespie and Oscar Peterson. And then as the television age began, Ms. Collins became a fixture of the Canadian small screen, becoming the first woman and the first black person to headline a national TV show. Eleanor Collins died yesterday. She was 104. Here she is, back when she was turning 100, speaking to the CBC about her forward-looking approach to life.
If this is the first time you looked out and saw the leaves and said, oh, damn, I have to go and rake them, you see, go out and just look at them, at the beauty. And they're magnificent just when they're ready to fade away. Isn't that funny? You know, just when they're to, and there's a song about that, you know, just as a tree is sure, its leaves will reappear. It knows its emptiness is just the time of year. So in this world of snow, of things that come and go, where what you think you know, you can't be certain of. You must believe in spring and love. That's the thing that my mother said to me long time ago. She said, my dear, you just take one day at a time. Do the best you can that day. And just keep moving. Just keep moving. And it's the best advice one could give one. Because, I mean, you can't stop and say, is this the end? What do you do? You just keep moving.
That was Canada's First Lady of Jazz, Eleanor Collins, speaking to the CBC 4 years ago as she turned 100. Marcus Mosley was a friend of Ms. Collins and is a jazz singer himself. We reached him in Vancouver.
Marcus, what does that clip of Eleanor Collins conjure up for you?
Oh, my God. Well, the afternoon that she invited me to her apartment and we sat and looked over the skyline and drank tea together, and she told me that story, and it just reminded me of my sense of her, is that she was a person who kept moving. She never allowed circumstances to block her or to stop her. She would just keep moving, and she would find a way to move forward and get things done that she knew she needed to and wanted to get done.
Was she always, I've seen a few clips, and she's just, the quotes, the lines from songs are right at the tip of her tongue.
Absolutely. Yeah, during that afternoon with her, there were a few times where she would just, again, like that, break into song or quoting the lyrics from a song to illustrate the point of whatever she was making in the conversation. So that was, to me, it was like sitting at the feet of an elder and just sort of taking in life lessons and learning.
You mentioned the obstacles and the difficulties that she refused, you know, to stop her, really. But there were many. Just tell us what she told you about what she and her family faced moving to Burnaby, but also as a performer.
Well, I think some people have heard the story of her initially wanting to move to Burnaby, and then the neighborhood, the whites in the neighborhood didn't want a black person moving there. There was resistance, and instead of responding in anger and whatever, she decided to volunteer and to teach music, and that was the way of winning people over.
It's quite something, just when you think about it. You're told that you're unwelcome from the get-go in your neighborhood simply because you're black and your family's black. You stay, and then you say, I'm gonna make sure my presence is known in the school. And also not to carry anger or bitterness, as it appears, you know, in the clips that we've seen. How did she tell you she did that? There must have been times she was angry.
Oh, of course. Well, because of her spiritual belief system, she wasn't from like a heavy fundamentalist Christian background. She was from a more universal science of mind kind of background. And her belief system, we're all connected. There's an interconnectedness between everything. And you receive back the energy you put out into the world. And so she very much lived and walked that truth. She believed that you overcome dark with light. You overcome hatred with love. You overcome resistance with love and with peace and with persistence and walking in the truth that you know, rather than letting that define you or determine who you are. And she lived that out throughout her life.
And then she had the 1954 show on CBC Vancouver, Bambula, A Day in the West Indies. That was the first Canadian TV show with a mixed race cast. Again, 1954, we're talking live music. And then she had her own show, The Eleanor Show, the first woman, the first black artist to headline their own national TV series. Did she tell you anything about those days?
She just told me about it was hard work, and she just wanted to, the way she explained it to me is that when the opportunities came, she stepped up, and she just knew that she had to go in and be fully prepared, be her best, be the best on the stage. It wasn't about ego or about trying to be a grand dame or whatever. It was that was her work ethic. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to do the absolute best job I can do.
Was she proud? Did she allow herself to be proud of everything she accomplished?
Yeah, she had a sense of pride in the way that hard work is rewarded with a sense of accomplishment. And I think she had that and thought that she had made a contribution. And I was so happy that she lived long enough to begin to receive recognition, like even getting her image on a stamp, Canada Post honoring her that way. I was so happy that she got to get her flowers in advance, that people didn't wait till after she was gone.
To an amateur, to someone who just loves music, her voice is beautiful, her presentation is beautiful. But for you as a musician and a collaborator of sorts, what was it about her that made her interpretation of songs so beautiful?
Well, I'll just go back to, I invited her back to one of my Black History Month concerts. And I said, would you please come back and bless us again? And she said, I think I will. I have one more thing to say before I hang up my hat, as it were. And she sang the song, Ears to Life. And at that point, I think she was like 97. And very frail. We had to give her a headset because she couldn't hold on to a regular microphone for a long period of time. It was just too heavy for her. And she then began to sing this song, and it was a master class. She didn't have the vocal range that she had in her youth. She didn't have the physical energy that she had in her youth, but she knew how to sing a phrase in such a way that would just make you sit on the edge of your seat, and she could talk through some of it, sing through some of it. It was a master class in how to perform, how to deliver a song. And by the end of the song, everybody's in tears and on their feet.
I'm going to cry right now hearing you describe it, Marcus.
Yeah.
Sounds like magic.
It was phenomenal. And then when she's finished that and we spoke the next day or so, she goes, I think I'm done as far as public performances. I think I've said what I wanted to say and need to say. So I felt honored that I was able to provide a platform in that concert for her to do that statement. And it was wonderful to witness.
Marcus, I very much appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Nita.
Marcus Mosley is a Vancouver singer. He was a friend of Eleanor Collins, Canada's First Lady of Jazz, who died yesterday at the age of 104.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Haiti's prisons are usually overcrowded, but today two of them sit quiet and largely empty. The country is under a state of emergency, and at least a dozen people are dead after gangs targeted the country's two biggest prisons this weekend, freeing thousands of inmates. The prison breaks follow a string of attacks on state institutions in Port-au-Prince, including Haiti's International Airport and its National Soccer Stadium. Pierre Espérance is the executive director of the National Human Rights Defense Network in Haiti. We reached him in Port-au-Prince.
Pierre, as we've said, there's a state of emergency, a curfew. How would you describe what Port-au-Prince is like today?
Well, what should I say? The situation in Port-au-Prince today is terrible. Since 1 week, the gang, they are very active. Mm-hmm. And since almost 1 week, there is no police officer in any station. We usually have a police officer. The street, they are completely empty. Most of the offices are closed, but my office was open. We went to the office today, but even the administration of the state, the office of the state are closed.
You went to your office despite everything that's going on.
Well, we know the population need us. It's not like because we feel we are secure, but we need to serve the population.
How do you protect yourself?
Well, as a human rights defender, we are very limited. We don't have a bodyguard. It's dangerous. If you ask me how do I protect myself, I don't know the answer. We don't take any special measure because it costs a lot of money, and human rights defender doesn't have money, and We continue to help the population in the difficult situation they have today.
When we talk about what happened at these two prisons on Saturday, we know an AFP reporter who was visiting the National Penitentiary said that they saw about a dozen bodies outside, that the gate was open, and that there was, quote, hardly anyone left inside. What do you know about what happened at these prisons?
Okay, first of all, since 1 week, the two coalition gangs in metropolitan area in Port-au-Prince, they said they want to break down two prisons, the national prison in Port-au-Prince, and also the other one in Croix-des-Bouquets. Even they say that the government, the director of the police, didn't take any action to prevent that. And then that's why on Saturday, they didn't find any resistance, and most of the prisoners left the prison.
And these are prisoners the government says are there, you know, because of kidnapping, murder, and other serious crimes. You mentioned there has been no police resistance. At the same time, there is the state of emergency and curfew, as we mentioned. Do you think that that is going to have any impact on this violence?
I don't know what will happen. I don't know what will happen tomorrow. I don't know if they will stop or they will continue. We never know. We never know what will happen. We don't know if the government will make a deal with the gang, because there are so a lot of members of the government who are in connection with the gang, and also the leadership of the police. Who knows? Who knows what will happen? Mm-hmm.
Ariel Henry is out of the country, as we know, trying to drum up support for a UN-backed security force. You wrote last fall a piece for The New York Times. It was called "Haiti Doesn't Need More Guns, It Needs a New Government." What will stop what is unfolding, if not for a show of force, in your view?
Okay. I didn't say police doesn't need a kind of support. Mm-hmm. I didn't say Haiti doesn't need any force. I think police need a lot of support. But at the same time, we have a dysfunctional government. We have a political instability. We have an absence of a rule of law and governance. And the force will not fix this problem for us. It's a package. We need to have a functional government. Because if the forces arrive in Haiti next week, in 2 weeks, or in 3 weeks, who will be the interlocutor? Mm-hmm. Who will deal with the force? It will not work.
Ariel Henry, he keeps pushing the promise of elections and, you know, says the violence and the gangs are the reason we can't hold elections because there's too much instability. So how long can this cycle continue?
Well, I am not the one who will say Dr. Ariel Henry will need to step down today or tomorrow. Mm-hmm. The only thing I can say, the reality is what it is. Dr. Ariel Henry has been in power since July 2021, with the support of a international community, U.S., Canada, and United Nations. Dr. Ariel Henry show is not capable to manage the country by himself, to move the country to the election.
Mm-hmm. What should those countries, Canada at the top of the list, what should Canada and other countries do then? Now,
I will not ask them to come out with a public statement to say they will not support Ariel Henry, they want mm-hmm. Ariel Henry to do this or that. But I think they can meet with him and come with a strong message to tell him he need to do a lot of concession, he need to share a power, he need to move the country on the rule of law, democracy, and governance. And also, because they expend a lot of money in Haiti, I think a U.S., Canada, United Nations can facilitate a negotiation, a dialogue to move on an agreement on rule of law and to move for the election.
Pierre, thank you for your time. Stay safe.
Okay. Thank you.
Pierre Esperance is the executive director of the National Human Rights Defense Network in Haiti. We reached him in Port-au-Prince. Caitlin Clark is on fire.
She ties it with that one. This for college basketball history. She does it with a foul shot. Caitlin Clark becomes the all-time leading scorer in major college basketball history, passing Pistol Pete Maravich a record that's lasted for 54 years.
Yeah, last night the Iowa Hawkeyes point guard became the all-time leading scorer in NCAA basketball history. Not women's basketball, not Iowa basketball, all Division I college basketball in the U.S. As you just heard, that achievement puts her ahead of NBA Hall of Famer Pistol Pete Maravich. And as you also just heard, it's a record that took more than a half century to break. Kristen Meyer was Caitlin's high school coach at Dowling Catholic High School in West Des Moines, Iowa. That's where we reached her.
Kristen, you were watching as that happened. What were you saying and doing when you saw that go through?
It was kind of a surreal moment. You know, like everyone else in Carver Hawkeye Arena, we all just kind of went wild and you know, cheered as loud as we could. And you know, I don't know if we expected it to come off of a free throw, but you know, considering how her other record-breaking shot was that deep logo three, it was kind of fitting because she has shot a lot of free throws over her career.
Your voice is hoarse. Is it because you've been cheering and screaming?
Probably actually from coaching last week.
Yeah.
I'm still a high school basketball coach, and we were in the state tournament last week, so I'm still recovering from that.
Understandable. You know, for people who haven't had a chance to watch Caitlin play on television or in person, what makes Caitlin a star?
I think she embodies all aspects of the game that are exciting and fun to watch and fun to cheer for. I mean, she's kind of known for logo threes, but for me, I really enjoy watching her passing. She is just an incredible passer. She sees the floor so well. But beyond that, she just plays with such a passion and a competitiveness that she's just so fun to watch. You can just feel her joy for the game and joy for competing when you see her play.
Did you see signs of this when you were coaching her?
Yeah, you know, she was always a standout athlete and standout basketball player, and I probably didn't appreciate it as much in the moment as I do now. As a coach, you get so caught up in just preparing for the next game and then in-game, you know, next play mentality that I probably didn't take time to appreciate it. But she has always been an incredible basketball player and has just had the ability to do things on the court that other players cannot do.
Let's play a little bit of tape now. This is tape of Caitlin Clark reacting to those record-breaking moments.
It's really, like, crazy to think about. Like, honestly, if you would have told me that before my college career started, I would have laughed in your face and been like, no, you're insane. And, like, I've always been able to score the ball, but I don't think people really understand how many amazing players have come before me and, like, been able to score the ball and do it at such a high rate and do it for teams that are really, really good. And just to be in the same realm of all these players that have been so successful, whether it's Pete or whether it's Kelsey Plum or Lynette Woodard, like, all these people have just given so much to the game. So, you know, hopefully somebody comes after me and breaks my records and I can be there supporting them. And that's what makes the game of basketball so fun. But, yeah, it'll definitely hit me at some point.
It's interesting to hear her say that as someone who doesn't know her and who certainly didn't coach her, because, you know, you describe someone who's ambitious and aggressive on the court, but she's saying she did not imagine this for herself.
Yeah, and I think as far as the records go, she never set out to break a ton of records. They've just been the result of all the work she's put in. She just wanted to have as much fun as she could have and challenge herself to become the best player she could be. And along the way, these records have kind of just, you know, come as a result of that. And so it's really fun to hear her say those things, because while she appreciates the opportunity, you know, to break records and bring a spotlight to women's basketball, that was never her goal. She just loves playing and wants to challenge herself to see how good she can get.
Well, there's certainly a well-deserved spotlight on her and the sport. Would you describe her as an unselfish player?
Yes, and I think she's grown in that throughout her college career. You know, in high school, she could score. She could get a shot off at any time. And so sometimes she would just like to shoot because she knew she could. And I think as she's grown and matured, she's seen the value and the excitement in getting teammates more involved, because she could shoot a whole lot more than she does now, but she enjoys seeing her teammates' reactions when they make a three-point shot that she assisted. And so I think she's just grown in her love and appreciation for the game and all aspects of the game.
She's still eligible for college ball, but last week she announced she'd forgo a fifth season at the University of Iowa for the WNBA draft. Do you envision even further growth as a pro player?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, as we've seen in college, she just keeps stepping up to the challenge. You know, going from high school to college, she was going against players 3 to 4 years older who are stronger and quicker and more experienced. And now as she transitions to go play against professional athletes, I mean, some of these women will be 15, you know, 10 to 15 years older than her and have so much experience. So I think that will drive her to adapt to that level of play.
You mentioned you're coaching, you know, the high school team and they went to the playoffs. What kind of impact do you think Caitlin has had over the last few years on that team?
Yeah, you know, I've told a number of people this. Right now we hear about the Caitlin Clark effect and all these little boys and girls who are wearing Caitlin Clark jerseys and are out in the driveway practicing, you know, shots and, you know, pretending they're Caitlin Clark. We've been pretty lucky here at Dowling Catholic High School that the athletes I have right now in high school, they were in middle school and elementary when Caitlin was in high school. So that Caitlin Clark effect has come a little bit early for us. That's one of the reasons why we've been so successful these past few years is because these players grew up watching Caitlin firsthand, and really that motivated them to work on their game and fall in love with the sport.
Have you had a chance to chat with her since?
Last week I did a little bit, and you know I don't get too wrapped up in the records, just like I know she doesn't get too wrapped up in that. And so I never offer any coaching advice or anything now. I just get to be a big supporter, a big fan. And so I like to, you know, just text back and forth once in a while just to let her know I enjoyed watching her play or, you know, wish her good luck, things like that. I texted her on Thursday after she made the announcement and told her because it was the same day that our high school team had just won the semifinal game. Yeah. So we qualified to play in the state championship game. And that was the first time that we had done that in 10 years. And I said, sure, Caitlin, you'll make your big announcement right after we win our state semifinal game just to steal our thunder, you know, kind of joking around with her. And so it was fun. We went back and forth a little bit. And, you know, she's still a huge supporter of Dowling Catholic Athletics and our team. And so it's just really fun to kind of keep in touch and see, yeah, you know, the impact she's having across the world.
Coach Meyer, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on and running this story about Caitlin.
Kristen Meyer is NCAA point guard Caitlin Clark's former basketball coach. We reached Coach Meyer at Dowling Catholic High School in West Des Moines, Iowa. When Arwin Jordan Regenball finally got a copy of their driver's license with the gender marker X on it, it should have been a happy day. Instead, the hard-fought win back in January was tainted by the fact that Arwin was the only person in the province of Quebec with that option. At the time, the province said others would have to wait until 2025 to request the same modification to their IDs. But now it has changed its tune. We reached Arwin Jordan Regenball in Montreal.
Arwin, is today a day to celebrate now that others can do what you were able to do?
Yes. We're cautiously celebrating currently. We're happy that Quebec will finally be entering the 21st century and doing the right thing. But at the same time, legal recognition is really only the beginning. Now that we have legal identities and can prove our identities, we need to make sure that our community can continue to flourish and meaningfully participate in society.
For listeners who might not know, you were able to do this, to get a driver's license,
mm-hmm,
using you know, an X as the gender marker, mm-hmm, because of an out-of-court agreement,
yes,
after you filed a complaint with the Human Rights Commission. Why, mm-hmm, did you want to take on that fight and on your own at that time?
For me, it was always about I should have the legal rights that everyone else has, and that is to have an ID document that reflects their legal identity. But it was also about making sure that no one else would have to do that fight. Unfortunately, it didn't occur exactly as I planned, but this news brings me a bit closer to knowing and being reassured that no one else will have to do what I did.
You got your driver's license, but you had not obtained a new health card. Were you able to do that today?
No, I've called the people who issue the health cards, and they've informed me that it'll take a few days for them to kind of realize what the government has said and to implement it. So there's still some work that needs to be done. But I'm quite eager to finally be able to access health services without having to explain to all my providers the mistake on the health card.
What does that entail for folks who haven't had to do that, not having this kind of ID, specifically the health card? Mm-hmm. What does that mean for you?
Every time I access a health service or attempt to prove my identity, I have to explain to the person why the gender on the document is erroneous and why it doesn't reflect my legal identity. And that forces me to effectively come out to every person who handles that document. And it's a very heavy burden to constantly be carrying around with you. When we needed proofs of vaccination, I avoided leaving my house. I was fully vaccinated, and I avoided leaving my house because I didn't want to have those discussions everywhere I went. Mm. So it is quite extensive in its effects on your life.
The province previously was saying that it wanted to wait on the final report from a committee on gender identity before making these changes possible. What changed the province's mind, do you think?
I think it was a combination of many factors. I think they realized the eventual, you know, court challenge that would occur, kind of like the whole Bill 2 court challenge, which was the one that required they issue a gender-neutral birth certificates. I think that they essentially looked in the mirror and said, we don't want that fight to occur again, and it's better off for us, and it'll be a lower cost if we just do it rather than fight them tooth and nail.
The committee itself, I know, was a concern for you and others, mm-hmm. the makeup of the committee in particular.
It was. There's no transgender non-binary representation on the committee. When asked about that, the minister said, well, the committee is not there to represent them. And the minister was for families was even asked, would you establish a women's rights committee with no women on it? And she had to think about it and went, probably not. So that's concerning to us and very alarming. Mm-hmm.
Do you think you've affected change beyond just getting ID?
I hope so. For me, ID reaffirms human dignity and is really the basis of accessing employment, banking, ability to go to school. A piece of ID is really critical to all of those. So the change will be quite vast once we have that recognition.
Are there folks who've been reaching out to you now that this has come through?
A few, yes. I participated in legal clinics that help people change their gender. And whenever someone requested an X marker, I had to tell them, well, you know, it's not currently possible. And until 2025, we don't think it will be. So now a few of them have started reaching out and saying, okay, well, what can I do? What are the next steps? Because I know that this will be available.
When you look across the country, you know, depending on where people live, different kinds of supporting documentation is required in some cases. I mean, just dealing with bureaucracy, and everybody in this country, wherever you live, knows mm-hmm. that's difficult, particularly when we're talking about these kinds of documents. And in some cases, changing a birth certificate is much harder than mm-hmm. changing a health card or a driver's license. So mm-hmm. what would help improve things across the board in your view?
For me, it would be what the federal government has done, which has been, you know, what they said is, we're going to print the gender you want on your passport based on a self-identification basis. I feel like that more accurately reflects people's identities rather than having to change a birth certificate. And then, you know, once that occurs, getting a sex change certificate, mm-hmm. there's so many complexities when, you know, other governments have just gone on a self-identification basis. Mm-hmm.
There might still be those listening who think this is all unnecessary, you know, that why do these changes need to happen? What would you say to them?
I understand their concern, but just like if they obtained a driving license and the government made a mistake in their birthday or their name, they'd want that corrected. And at the end of the day, it's the same for me. Mm-hmm. My ID had a mistake in it, and I wanted it to be corrected.
Arwin, I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
In January, Arwen Jordan Regenball became the first person in Quebec to have the gender marker X on their driver's license. Today, the province announced that others can join them. We reached Arwen in Montreal. Emily Blacklock has tagged a lot of lobsters. In fact, she and a lab mate have tagged more than 2,000 of them in the Bay of Fundy. They're part of a team of researchers at the University of New Brunswick who are trying to get a better idea of how to determine a lobster's age. The team is used to getting reports from fishers who've caught their lobsters, but a recent catch happened a little farther away than they expected. We reached Emily Blacklock in St. John.
Emily, it was social media that tipped you off. How did you come across this lobster?
I've been following Jacob on Instagram for a long time and always love watching his videos. And I saw a video and I watched it once and then I watched it again and I watched a third time to make sure that I saw what I saw, but I saw one of our tagged lobsters down in Maine.
Tell our listeners who Jacob is.
Jacob Knowles is an Instagram and TikTok sensation in the lobster industry who always posts videos of what he does on the fishing boat.
So you just happened to be following him. He didn't expect to find this lobster that's being used for this particular purpose. Am I right?
Absolutely not. He didn't even know that it was a Canadian lobster when he found it.
What did he think it was?
He thought it was a study that was done in Maine because they do a lot of studies down there as well.
And so how far had it traveled?
So after 421 days, it traveled some distance that we're not exactly sure because we don't know what path it followed. But if we drew a straight line from where it was tagged in St. Martin's, New Brunswick, mm-hmm. directly down to Maine where it was caught, it would be about 256 kilometers.
Have you seen a lobster? Have you guys tracked this, you and the team, a lobster go this far?
We haven't done that at this time. Lots of studies over the years have shown that lobsters go all the way through the Bay of Fundy down to Maine. Mm-hmm. But we didn't expect necessarily that a lobster would be caught down there and then also reported back to us. When I saw it, I was just shocked that he was the one to have caught it and then to make a video about it.
So it's not a super lobster.
It's not a super lobster.
You're tagging these lobsters to try to find a way to tell how old lobsters are. Just tell our listeners a little bit more about the study.
So the study is being run by Dr. Remy Rochette out of the University of New Brunswick, St. John. What we're doing is we're tagging lobsters when they're too small to be caught in Canada mm-hmm. with a small identification tag and taking a tissue sample and then releasing them back in the water. And what our hope is that when someone catches it, when it is a legal-sized lobster, that we can buy it back from them and take another tissue sample to compare it.
Why is it so hard to tell how old they are? You can't tell from size or their shell?
So if it was like a tree where you could cut it in half and count the rings, that would be fantastic. And animals that have hard parts like bones, you can do something similar. But with lobsters, when they molt to grow, they shed their entire shell. Mm-hmm. So none of the hard parts stay with them.
So it's just a wild guess at this point that people are making.
Some people have had lobsters in tanks for years. Mm-hmm. And from that, those scientists that have kept them in tanks can understand their age to their size. But that's in a tank and not necessarily in the wild and the conditions that they would face, especially in the Bay of Fundy.
What can that information, the age of a lobster, what can that teach us?
So one thing that it can be very helpful for is fisheries management to understand how long a lobster is taking to get to a certain size. But even more than that, I think the general public always sees posts of massive lobsters being caught and always wonder exactly how old they are. And at this point, we can't tell you exactly how old they are. We're always just guessing.
How far along are you in the research right now?
Right now, we have done 2 years of tagging. So mm-hmm. we tagged in 2022 and 2023. Myself, as well as another PhD student, Lydia White, both go and tag throughout the lobster fishing area 36 with mm-hmm. lots of our fishers that work very hard with us. So we've tagged over 2,000 lobsters so far.
Are you tired of tagging lobsters, Emily?
I don't know if I could ever get tired of tagging lobsters.
So this particular lobster, the one that triggered this conversation and that social media post and your conversation with Jacob. It has been released, as I understand it. Do you think you're going to get news of it again?
I sure hope we do. It was great that he posted that video because we can actually get the size from the video based off things that we can see in the clip with the lobster. Mm-hmm. But he's actually also been a very big help to all of the main community of lobster fishermen to tell them about this lobster so that we can hope that if it is caught again, we'll hear back from them.
And do you think it'll get out the word more now? So when people see the blue tag, they know exactly what it's for. Have you guys put out the word in other ways as well?
I think his videos will absolutely help with getting the word out. Everyone follows him who fishes, and they all know about his videos, so it makes it very aware to everybody. We've also been very, very open about the study on social media, mm-hmm. have posters at all the wharfs, talk to the fishers, and make sure they know exactly what's going on.
Maybe the lobster knew Jacob was famous, too. He wanted to make sure he got on the gram.
Maybe.
Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
Emily Blacklock is a PhD candidate at the University of New Brunswick, St. John. We reached her in St. John. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.